including studies on quantum mechanics, that I began to understand the profound nature of my boyhood hero Einstein's contribution to our world. While I flourished academically, in other areas I was a poster child for dysfunction, especially in the realm of relationships. I married in my 20s when I was too young and too emotionally immature to be ready for a meaningful relationship. When after 10 years of marriage I told my father I was getting a divorce, he adamantly argued against it and told me, "Marriage is a business." In hindsight, my father's response made sense for someone who emigrated in 1919 from Russia, engulfed in famine, pogroms, and revolution. Life for my father and his family was unimaginably hard, and survival was always in question. Consequently, my father's definition of a relationship was a working partnership in which marriage was a means of survival, similar to the recruitment of mail-order brides by hardscrabble pioneers who homesteaded the Wild West in the 1800s. My parents' marriage echoed my father's business-first attitude, even though my mother, who was born in America, did not share his philosophy. My mother and father worked together 6 days a week in a successful family business, but none of their children can recall seeing them share a kiss or a romantic moment. As I entered my early teens, the dissolution of their marriage became apparent when my mother's anger over a loveless relationship exacerbated my father's drinking. My younger brother and sister and I hid in our closets as frequent verbally abusive arguments shattered our formerly peaceful home. When my father and mother finally decided to live in separate bedrooms, an uneasy truce prevailed. As many conventionally unhappy parents did in the 1950s, my parents stayed together for the sake of the children. They divorced after my youngest brother left home for college. I only wish they had known that modeling their dysfunctional relationship was far more damaging to the children than their separation would have ever been. At the time, I blamed my father for our dysfunctional family life. But with maturity, I came to realize that both of my parents were equally responsible for the disaster that sabotaged their relationship and our family harmony. More importantly, I began to see how their behavior, programmed into my subconscious mind, influenced and undermined my efforts to create loving relationships with the women in my life. In the meantime, I experienced years of pain. The dissolution of my own marriage was emotionally devastating, especially because my two wonderful daughters, now grown into loving and accomplished women, were just little girls. The divorce was so devastating that I vowed never to marry again. Convinced that true love was a myth, at least for me, every day for 17 years I repeated this mantra when I shaved. With every stroke of the razor I spoke, "I won't get married again. I won't get married again." Needless to say, I wasn't committed relationship material. But despite my morning ritual, I couldn't ignore what is a biological imperative for all organisms, from single cells to our 50 trillion cell bodies, the drive to connect with another organism. The first big love I experienced was a cliché. An older man with a bad case of arrested emotional development falls in love with a younger woman and experiences an intense, hormone-driven teenage-style affair. For a year, I floated happily through life, high on love potions. The neurochemicals and hormones coursing through my blood that you'll hear about in Chapter 3. When my teenage-style love affair inevitably crashed and burned, saying she needed space, she rode her bicycle a very short space away into the arms of a cardiovascular surgeon. I spent a year in my big empty house, wallowing in pain and pining for the woman who had left me. Cold turkey is horrible, not just for heroin addicts, but also for those whose biochemistry reverts to everyday hormones and neurochemicals in the wake of a failed love affair. One cold Wisconsin winter day, I was sitting alone, as usual, in a chair, ruminating again about the woman who had left me. I suddenly thought, "God damn it, leave me alone!" A wise voice that occasionally appears at pivotal times of my life responded, "Bruce, isn't that exactly what she did?" I burst out laughing, and that broke the spell. From then on, any time I started obsessing, I would laugh. Finally, I'd gotten past withdrawal through laughter, though I still had a long way to go to get my act together. How far I was from getting my act together became crystal clear to me when I moved to the Caribbean to teach at an offshore medical school. I was living in the most beautiful place on earth, in a villa by the ocean with gorgeous, sweet-smelling flowers. The villa even came with a gardener and a cook. I wanted to share my new life with someone, though of course not get married. I was still fixated on my morning mantra. I wanted more than a